Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, co-host Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., super endocrinologist. Today, we're going to be talking about diabetes. We're going to quickly discuss the different types, discuss the definitions as well of, you know, diabetes mellitus, insipidus. We could throw those things in there as well. Well, just very quickly, because if you just say, so the issue is, if you ever say diabetes online, there are people in those communities that get upset because you don't differentiate. We should be differentiating because they are extremely different etiology. So my brother's an endocrinologist. I play one on the internet. So let's get into it. So where does the word diabetes, you know, come from? What in mellitus versus insipidus, all that stuff? If you could just differentiator.
I mean, you know, this historically, because of high sugars, and really diabetes means urinating too much, and mellitus means sugar, essentially. So
sweetness,
really,
right? Isn't it
sweetness? Yeah, sweetness. So it comes from, you know, once upon a time, and I haven't like talked or about this or heard about this in a while, but, you know, off the top of my head, as I recall, the original diagnoses were made by tasting urine, sweetness in the urine. And so,
delicious.
Too much sugar in your blood overwhelms your kidneys' ability to hold that sugar in, and you pee out your sugar, and that's diabetes mellitus. That's where that came from, even though there are all very many different, like you said, really etiologies, meaning causes of that. And, you know, we could really get into the weeds later on and talk about how, you know, it's really almost more of a symptom or a consequence of different disease pathology, but that's the basics. That's where that comes from. And then there is, you mentioned something called diabetes insipidus, which you probably don't see.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
You probably refer to endocrinologists.
Maybe seen it once.
Like me. And that, again, diabetes means excessive urination, but the insipidus part is when the back part of our pituitary isn't working right and we're losing our anti-diuretic hormone, essentially. So we're just peeing out a lot of water.
Yeah.
That's actually a, you know, so we have to deal with that on a whole nother different basis.
Yeah. That's not what we won't be discussing that. We just wanted to throw out some definitions there. So, okay. So the major types that people kind of screw up are the type one diabetes mellitus, which most people call is just type one diabetes. And then there's type two diabetes. And again, like you said, there's probably multiple etiologies within those, I suppose, but
And there are other very specific causes of diabetes mellitus. There are some very specific genetic causes. We call those monogenic diabetes that have to do with, you know, essentially the pancreas not working right for very specific reasons and causes in that regard. There are patients who have something called cystic fibrosis, and they have issues with their pancreas that include also just other parts of the cells of the pancreas rather than just the insulin secreting cells. People might be familiar with cystic fibrosis as a young person disease of the lungs, but it also causes diabetes. And so, you know, we often see those patients. You can get diabetes from having recurrent or even one bad bout of pancreatitis. So that can, you know, cause you to not have insulin, to not allow your blood sugar to get put in your cells. And so then your sugars go high. There are people who have had surgeries of their pancreas and they don't have a pancreas. So that's a cause. Other conditions, when people have to use steroids, glucocorticoid steroids, they cause insulin resistance and high blood sugars. And so there are steroid-induced diabetes. And also after organ transplants, this can happen. And then there are some severe, rare forms of like insulin resistance, things called lipodystrophy, where your healthy fat cells don't work anymore. And that can also happen with HIV and treating AIDS. through both the medications and maybe the disease process itself. And then, of course, people are also generally pretty familiar with gestational diabetes, which can have some risk factors, just like what we're going to talk about today. That's type 2 diabetes, but also that has to do with placenta hormones, and it's its own thing. It's its own thing that's diagnosed during pregnancy, not at the beginning or before pregnancy. That would be, we would call that pre-gestational diabetes. And we do need to be more aware of that, by the way. We need to be more aware of people who have risk factors for diabetes mellitus in general, and be checking young women of reproductive age for diabetes before, at the beginning of pregnancy, not just trying to diagnose what we call gestational diabetes in the middle of pregnancy.
Yeah. But going back to like just type 1 and type 2, what most people refer to, type 1, can you explain it?
Yeah. So type 1 basically is an autoimmune disease. And so you get what they call beta cell destruction. So beta cells are the pancreatic cells that make insulin. And insulin is what tells the rest of our body cells, like especially our healthy fat cells and muscle cells, to pull the glucose or sugar from our blood in. And so this leads to an insulin deficiency, and it requires insulin therapy because your pancreas is not working. Now, there's a spectrum of disease severity even in this, where especially if this happens in adulthood, because it used to be thought that, oh, this was only in young, thin children, and it was that's how people used to think of it differentially. So they used to think of type 1 diabetes as in kids and type 2 in adults, but that's not true. It can happen in anybody. We even find very people in their 80s and 90s who develop type 1 diabetes.
Oh, jeez.
But it actually isn't quite as severe. So that beta cell, that pancreas destruction, is not quite as severe oftentimes in adulthood as it is in youth. You can think of it as, well, they haven't been able to develop their pancreas as well over their lifetime yet. And so so their pancreas still often works a little bit better or a little bit longer in adulthood. And then everyone is a little bit different with different genetics and different backgrounds and stuff like that. So that's the type 1 diabetes. And it's associated with other autoimmune disease, like Hashimoto's, autoimmune thyroid disease, or the opposite of that, the Graves' disease, celiac disease, adrenal insufficiency. These are more rare autoimmune diseases, like the adrenal insufficiency and some others. But, Hashimoto's is pretty common. In fact, you have Hashimoto's, and thus you have a little bit of an increased risk of type 1 diabetes, more than general population.
If I start pissing out a lot, I go check my sugar.
Yeah, if you give me a text pissed. And you say you're dry, you're urinating, you're just drinking tons of water, you're losing weight inappropriately, and your vision is blurred, that would be a slam dunk concern.
Yeah, I got some glucometers around here. Okay, so the deficiency of insulin is also important for signaling the liver not to spit out a bunch of glucose as well. I guess it's just another thing there. Okay, so type 2 diabetes, what it's traditionally thought of as.
Yeah, so type 2 diabetes is a much more what we call heterogeneous, meaning there's a lot more to it. And it's not just like a kind of a single thing.
Yeah.
And I like to refer to it as really, it's a disease of obesity, the true definition of obesity, as we talked about, a disease of abnormally excess or abnormally distributed adipose tissue that has a lot of different dysfunctions throughout the body. Ultimately, it does have a kind of common denominator with, say, type 1 diabetes, is that the pancreas ultimately can't keep up with it. But, everyone has a sort of individual threshold for how much their healthy fat cells can start storing or can store energy, right? And so different people at different levels of excess adiposity or obesity suddenly become insulin resistant because their healthy fat cells, I tell patients, they kind of say, all right, you know what? I've had enough. That's it. And so, talking about the complexity of obesity pathophysiology, go back to one of our earlier podcasts, but it's hard in itself. And so then different individuals with different genetic backgrounds, different levels of fitness, their healthy fat cells have different thresholds at which they say, all right, that's enough is enough. We're not going to expand anymore. So that's a term you might hear about called expandability. And then all that energy that's excess One, there's already insulin resistance going on in the healthy fat cells, right? Our peripheral subcutaneous fat cells. And then we start storing the adipose, well, not tissue, but like triglycerides, fat cells.
Ectopic, yeah.
Fat ectopically. In our muscles, and that's called ectopic, or in our liver, in our abdominal area. So that's why we talk about abdominal obesity as a risk for diabetes and cardiometabolic disease, and also in our pancreas, which starts to work against us. So now we have all this insulin resistance from our healthy fat cells, our muscles, and our liver, and then our pancreas can't quite keep up with it. We actually have high insulin levels from the insulin resistance. The pancreas is trying to keep up, but then it starts to fail. And that's when sugars start to go up. And there's actually, you know, we talk a lot about trying to measure and diagnose insulin resistance, which is not quite, you know, we do it sometimes, but it's not quite ready for prime time because it doesn't really change what we're going to do. But then pre-diabetes, and we'll talk about diagnosis. But it's at in these levels before there's like a really, really high risk of the complications of high sugars in our blood that we call pre-diabetes. And then once that the beta cells just really can't keep up, then our sugar levels go into a range where we diagnose type 2 diabetes. And the dysfunctions throughout the body, I mean, it's not just our healthy adipose tissue that's dysfunctional, but like I said, that like you noted, the ectopic fat in our muscle cells, our liver. There's even changes in our brain that are similar to, say, just the disease of obesity, where we have increased appetite. There's a reduced dopamine surge in the, you know, like in the morning. There's increased what we call sympathetic tone. There are other parts of the pancreas that aren't working well. So there's alpha cell defects, and we have increased glucagon, which is the opposite of insulin. It's causing sugar to go up. And our kidneys aren't doing their job anymore. Like they're supposed to... you know, there's an increased glucose reabsorption instead of just letting it out. This gets into some of the treatments we have and all sorts of stuff. So the gut, you know, gut microbiome and all these things.
So what's the, yeah. So the bottom line is, can you get this, can you develop type 2, not type 1, type 2 diabetes without excess adipose tissue? And by excess, I mean, kind of in the definition of too much. Right. Which could be a threshold lower or higher for some individuals. Because people say, but thin people get type 2 diabetes. So it's not just the fat. And you've written actually, talking about fatty liver disease recently, but you've written some editorials about how it's still the adipose.
Right. So for most people, for sure, it's still a disease of adiposity. It's still the disease of obesity. Even if you're thin, let's say you don't have a lot of muscle, you have a what would be considered kind of a low BMI, but you have some genetic predisposition. And there are large ethnic groups, for example, South Asian ethnic groups who at lower BMIs store more of that excess adiposity in their abdominal areas, their ectopic fat, their liver, their pancreas, and their healthy fat cells don't work as well. So at lower BMIs, they're at a high risk of diabetes. And so for most people, it is a disease of obesity, even though it may not be a high BMI per se. You know, and then we could go all the way to the other extreme. I mentioned something called lipodystrophy, and there are all sorts of these. These are pretty rare diseases, but these are diseases where our healthy subcutaneous fat cells don't work, either from genetics or some other illnesses that happen, and it can be all of them or just parts of our body, and they can drive very severe insulin resistance and really high sugars, high triglycerides, all these other things. And you wouldn't say that those people have obesity per se. It's a very specific disease process, but it kind of is still an adiposity-based disease because it's their healthy fat cells that really just don't work for different reasons, not because they met a certain threshold or anything of excess adiposity. So, and then, you know, there are a lot of people, like I mentioned, the monogenic diabetes. There are probably a lot of people who have some of these types of diabetes, but they also have, you know, maybe a little bit of type 2 diabetes physiology. And sometimes it's hard to differentiate, especially for diagnose. The general, you know, medical professionals and general patients. But, you know, we try to think about those things.
Yeah. Okay. So diagnosis then, and we can get back into how to prevent and whatever, but diagnosis of, let's say, pre-diabetes then, not full-blown type 2 diabetes.
So like I talked about on that spectrum of, you know, of this, Yeah, especially like type 2 diabetes, or this adiposity-based diabetes. If you have a fasting morning blood sugar of 100 milligrams per deciliter up to 125, those are the units most people are going to be familiar with. That's in what we call a pre-diabetes range or impaired fasting glucose range. So those people have a much higher risk of progressing to the point of type 2 diabetes where the sugars are high enough to cause the leading the cause of blindness, retinopathy, or kidney disease, or nerve problems. If you do what we call an oral glucose tolerance test, drink 75 grams of a horrible syrup. That's what I tell people. I'm like, sorry, I really want you to do this 2-hour test. You're going to go get your blood drawn, and you're going to drink this horrible syrup. I've never done it, but everyone tells me it's horrible, so I trust what my patients say. And then they're going to check your sugar 2 hours later. And if you have a sugar of 140 to 199 milligrams per deciliter, that's impaired glucose tolerance or prediabetes also. And then, you know, we also check something called the hemoglobin A1C. And I think we've talked about that in other podcasts. This is basically a way that we can see what an average blood sugar is over 3 months, because it measures essentially the sugar on red blood cells. And red blood cells usually live about 3 months. And so we get these numbers. It's a percentage. And they correlate to an average blood sugar. But so an A1C of between 5.7 and 6.4% is pre-diabetes.
Yeah.
From an A1C perspective. And, you know, and we can talk about, well, you really should get two of those or two of the same to confirm the diagnosis. That's probably more important when we start saying, hey, someone has type 2 diabetes, which is essentially right above each of those thresholds I just talked about.
Yeah. Everybody's doing the CGMs now, and we have our podcast on the CGM. But it's funny, in high school, I did the glucola test, got the special stuff, and got a glucometer. And just wanted to see what happened. I felt like I was going to pass out because I was fasting. I'm not used to fasting, especially in high school, and I was trying to gain as much weight as possible. And I remember doing that test. It was not enjoyable. No. What about like some of these tests that during like the glucose tolerance test, they add on insulin and things like that? I mean, I know that, you know, how validated are these? I mean, well, there seems to be some correlation to the, it looks like they have some insulin resistance there, but ultimately the glucose does diagnose the diabetes or pre-diabetes, but might not show insulin resistance.
Right. So, these are ways we can, you know, dig a little bit deeper. They're really, they're relatively well validated to show that someone has insulin resistance and they're on that spectrum of potential risk of disease. But in the clinical setting, they really don't have a lot of utility. I mean, they're used in research a lot. And a lot of the people out there that we have to argue with, they're trying to sell people on these things, and because they're trying to sell them something and say, look, you have some insulin resistance. Well, we can pretty much assume someone has insulin resistance if they have these different body types, right? And if they are struggling with obesity, they don't have a lot of muscle. Let's say their fasting sugars aren't quite in the pre-diabetes range, but maybe they're high normal. You know, maybe you do a 2-hour sugar test on them and it's high, but not quite in pre-diabetes range. They have an A1C of 5.6. They have high triglycerides, low good cholesterol, HDL, which is metabolic syndrome. We know
even if it's, even if there's a trend. Even if there's, because we said before, the triglycerides, it's usually 150, but if there's even a trend, if it's even in the 90s, you know, the low hundreds, it's like, probably.
We can make some pretty good assumptions. And in that case, it's not going to change how, you know, you and I treat somebody or try to encourage them. Now, some people would argue, well, that helps encourage the patients know that, hey, they're on this realm.
Yeah, it might.
But, you know, there's also the issue with, well, what are the statistics? What's the actual risk of progressing to type 2 diabetes?
Right.
So even people with pre-diabetes, they don't all go on to type 2 diabetes.
There's a lot of debate around there because we're over-testing and then maybe we're over-prescribing metformin and things. Obviously, we want people to lift weights, be very active and be lean and mean, but if you're looking for the insulin resistance, like, and really digging deep, and, you know, it's not necessarily these people are going to be at any harm later. I mean, they're probably at an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, but will it change your management?
Right, exactly.
Will it change your management?
Exactly right. And in fact, you know, especially as we get older, we tend to start having a little bit higher sugars anyways. And so there's debate even in elderly, if we should even make a big deal about prediabetes at all, because they've made it that long with a little bit of this abnormal, what we'll call like dysglycemia, but they haven't progressed to you know, type 2 diabetes thresholds yet. And so the risks of those microvascular complications that we're talking about, really, are we going to be able to do anything intense that would be worth reducing that risk? Maybe not. So there is a lot of debate. And that's why we, as we always say, the conclusion is always individualized therapy. We got to take into account what's going on with the person, how old they are, what's their lifestyle, what's their family history. And then the other thing, this is a big point I think we need to do better as healthcare system. And I kind of alluded to this earlier. This really, type 2 diabetes is not really a disease of high sugars. It's a really holistic, global, personal disease of, you know, adipose tissue driving insulin resistance, cardiometabolic risk. It's really more of a cardiometabolic disease. And some people get high sugars because their pancreas ultimately fails and they can't keep up with it. And that's a big deal for those microvascular complications. And we want to have early intensive treatment to reduce the long-term risks of those things, keep their sugars down low. But then, you know, also on the other hand, if they're elderly, they don't have as long to actually, you know, get those risks. And so we don't necessarily have to be as intense. And so, you know, there's a lot of nuance to consider on any individual basis.
So then diagnosis of straight up type 2 diabetes, yep. You said the threshold's higher, but just throw them out there for people
listening. So a fasting blood glucose of 126 milligrams per deciliter or higher.
Usually you want that 2, you know, isn't the definition still 2? You want to get 2
That's
of
what
those.
I mean, yeah. So technically you want to have a confirmation or you have one of the other ones.
Yeah.
You know, like, so if you do get a glucose tolerance test, you'll have a fasting that could be that high, and then you'll have a 2-hour post, you know, glucose of 200 milligrams per deciliter or higher, or maybe you have an A1C of 6.5% or higher. I mean, you know, any two of those or two different confirmations of those could give us a diagnosis for a patient. You know, and to be honest, as you and I both know and tell people, it may or may not actually change how we want to treat the person. But it does give us an indication of their risk and their you know, these complications, and oftentimes it ends up being an insurance issue.
Yeah, that's the that's real issue, insurance, because you know, for us, we're going to push it lifestyle aggressively regardless. If they're below the threshold, we're throwing lifestyle hard. If they're above the threshold, we're throwing lifestyle hard. That's the big false dichotomy on Twitter right now. They're keto zealots, really, what they are. These people are basically like, these big pharma doctors, they don't care about lifestyle. It's like, no, we care about both, and we're extremely aggressive about lifestyle if we can get people to do it. But, you know, people have tried and failed, and some people, maybe they just don't want to do it. I don't know. That's not a reason not to treat these people. So I'd say it probably is a big insurance thing, because if somebody's teetering at 124, I mean, they got it. You know what I mean? Like,
right. And really, a lot of the medications we use for type 2 diabetes, we may want to use to help them lose the weight and prevent type 2 diabetes, because that will ultimately help prevent those complications we're talking about. You know, and you mentioned keto, and you mentioned CGMs, and why keto people think everyone needs to have CGMs, even people without diabetes or prediabetes and stuff like that. And so they think that eating zero carbs and having relatively then quote unquote normal sugars all the time, it solves their problem. But, you know, again, this goes back to type 2 diabetes. We really shouldn't consider it a completely glucose-centric disease of just elevated sugars. It's more than that. If you have obesity and you have type 2 diabetes and you make your sugars look like they're in remission because you're completely keto and you don't eat any carbs that make your sugar go up, you still have the other parts of the disease. You still have the increased cardiometabolic risks.
Unless they lost the weight with it.
Well, right. Well, but right. But the problem is, as we know, that doesn't really ultimately always solve the weight problem. And people regain the weight.
No, right.
You're right. So, exactly right. Yeah. So if the keto really helps you lose all the weight and you really do improve all your lipids, your blood pressure, your sugars and everything like that, then that is great.
But hypothetically, though, then it could help with microvascular complications.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. We just don't have specific data for that intervention.
It'd be nice to have that.
We have exceedingly strong data that glucose improvement, especially early on for the long run, dramatically reduces these microvascular complications like retinopathy or blindness, kidney disease, nerve disease. So yes, any dietary modification. And that's why, you know, carb reduction, we make fun of keto a lot, but cutting down carbs when you actually have type 2 diabetes or even type 1 diabetes, mind you, where there's to some degree some better evidence there, that is a good thing. So we do often help people cut their carbs when they have type 2 diabetes. It just isn't the only way to treat the obesity per se, and we got to do it in a good way, because there potentially can be other adverse effects, like if they have, you know, skyrocketing bad cholesterol, lipoproteins from, you know, different types of saturated fat and whatever. So anyways, that's just something to think about. But yes, treating the obesity is the primary target for type 2 diabetes. For pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, that is the primary target. And that's just been reaffirmed in some of the most recognized global guidelines. The European Association for the Study of Diabetes and ADA consensus statement just reaffirmed that. They make weight loss, treatment of obesity, a primary co-target. And then the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, just that I'm pretty heavily involved with, just published their diabetes update. And of course, you know, ACE has always been pretty proactive and progressive in treating obesity as the underlying driving cause of type 2 diabetes. So,
So adipocentric as opposed to glucose-centric. Yeah. Although getting your glucose down is probably a good idea.
It's very important. Yes. I don't want to, dismiss that at all. That is extremely important. And we have some of the best long-term data for all types of, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, especially for the long-term benefits of glycemic control, especially early on in the diagnosis, especially if you're younger than if it's diagnosed later, because you don't have as long to develop those problems.
Yeah. I just saw, there's a lot of people arguing that the hyperinsulinemia comes before the insulin resistance, and that's what kind of downregulates these insulin receptors and everything like that. I think still it doesn't, I think they have a long way of going to really confirm that. But the underlying issue, though, is excess energy, excess adipose. You don't see it in people who are truly lean with low levels of body fat, abdominally, ectopically, liver, pancreas, all that type of stuff, and subcutaneous.
It's interesting because going through all these years of medicine and study and endocrine fellowship and diabetes and stuff, all the data that the real researchers have done on diabetes have always shown that the insulin resistance comes first, then you have increased insulin levels, and then ultimately the common denominator, like I said before, is that beta cell dysfunction. You lose beta cell function and mass, and then you lose insulin, which is really what drives the hyperglycemia in diabetes. It has to do with, the intestine hormones that we talk about, those incretins that help the pancreas work better, the GLP, the GIP, the kidney, the glucose reabsorption. Now we have medications that target that. We have medications that target those healthy fat cells that become unhealthy and dysfunctional and not working anymore. And so these are all the different areas of the body that, we can target. But ultimately, the underlying driving force is the obesity that drives insulin resistance. So, insulinoma, we once in a while get those. I just had a patient recently that I diagnosed with insulinoma. Did I tell you that?
No. Careful with the HIPAA stuff, but what did you do for?
So basically, and we're always pretty skeptical because this is pretty rare. And so I had a lady, middle age, and I think her primary care called me because he said, this lady, she thinks she's going hypoglycemic, whatever. So I called her and I talked to her. I happened to be on call and she said, I feel like I have to eat all the time. Otherwise I get sweaty. I don't feel well. I get shaky and she's been gaining weight. Now she has obesity. And so, someone with obesity and gaining weight, you would think they might have some high sugars, right? Or insulin resistance. Well, her A1C was low, normal.
Hmm.
And then when we got her in the hospital and did a fasting glucose, it was, I don't remember, but it was low. And then the way we diagnose an insulinoma, it's a little bit complicated, but then you have to measure insulin and parts of the insulin and something called a C-peptide and these other things to make sure nothing else is going on. And all those things were high. Her sugars were low. And then, you know, we found the tumor growing on her pancreas, took it out. Now she's fine. And she's losing weight.
Now she has pancreatogenic.
No, it's not. Her whole pancreas isn't gone.
Yeah, no. Anyway.
But, you know, yeah. Okay.
Good.
There's that tangent.
Yeah. So prevention, we're going to have a guest on here who specializes in all things diet and type 2 diabetes and just looking at the different types of diet, whether it's very low calorie diets, ketogenic diets, and all this stuff. But for prevention purposes, you know, we're big fans of physical activity, obviously, Docs Who Lift. I'm doing a lecture on resistance training, and one of my slides is talking about how, like, hey, the more muscle you have, the more area you have to store glucose, but also acutely exercising can sensitize your muscles to insulin and also can actually take in glucose without even insulin.
Yeah.
So physical activity is very important, but then obviously, you know, diet and just staying lean and mean and active, and also sleep. People who don't, mm-hmm. who have erratic sleep schedules due to the circadian rhythms and other hormonal changes that occur with sleep deprivation can throw people for a loop when it comes to insulin resistance and the hormonal changes. Anything else specifically, obviously stress and lifestyle is extremely important for prevention.
And medications, of course, you know, there are medications that can, you know, work against people. The variable genetics that people have, you know, people, type 2 diabetes, you know, it's thought of to be more genetically predisposed than, say, type 1 diabetes, which is the autoimmune disease. But it's just a mixed bag. There's so many different genetic variables
they're talking about, just like obesity. Like six different phenotypes based on how much insulin they're secreting and how much insulin resistance they have. And it's really interesting stuff. I don't know how much it changes our management right now.
Yeah, it might. Some of that, what you're talking about, it might. I don't know that people out there would care as much, because it has to do more with, like, maybe the types of medicines, kind of like that. Like I said, the TZD, the pioglitazone, you know, is pretty good for people who are thinner with, where those healthy fat cells really don't work as well. Maybe the kind of that lipodystrophy sort of phenotype. And, you know, they fit into one of those little categories as opposed to,
We don't have a test right now where we can go, oh, yep, this is the way you should treat them just yet. I'm sure there will be some algorithms using artificial intelligence in the future. But for the gist of it, I think everybody got a good sense of the way we diagnose pre-diabetes, the risk factors for it, kind of the pathophysiology here. I think this will be a good primer for when we do an all things diet and type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, talking about remission versus reversing, if that's even a thing. Anything else that we need to discuss?
No, although you did, you know, you talked about how to personalize therapy. So people out there, if you're going to start medication, you're going to talk to your doctor about this and how to personalize therapy. The way we do it nowadays is based upon what other risk factors or what other complications you have. Do you have established heart disease? Do you have heart failure? Do you have kidney disease? Because that really can make a difference as to what medications are really, really, really important to be on. And so that's currently how we essentially personalize the therapy and which medications we're going to use. But otherwise, lifestyle is kind of across the board. And obviously, that has to be personalized anyways, based on patient preference and abilities and all that stuff. So
the way I personalize is GLP-1 or GTFO. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Now I have Anyway, all right. Thanks for listening. Hopefully this gives you a good primer on pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and differentiating between type 1 diabetes and even diabetes mellitus and all the other causes of diabetes mellitus, including pancreatogenic and lipodystrophy, all those different things, really interesting stuff.
That could be about 28 different podcasts on all those different things.
Yeah.
So you can let us know if you're really interested in that.
Maybe that might get a little bit dry, but this kind of covers
get pretty dry.
This covers most of everything. So thanks for listening. Give us a rating. Tell your friends to take a listen.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.